This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's the big data breaches we hear about. Thousands or even millions of credit card numbers compromised. 40 million credit and debit card numbers stolen during the holiday season from Target a couple years ago. As many as 22 million New Yorkers whose private information was compromised by hackers who penetrated state websites. The IRS, UPS, Staples, all targeted by hackers and criminals. But the smaller companies and businesses that are more vulnerable than those big ones we hear about are more of a target. In fact, a recent study showed that the vast majority of data breaches happen in companies with fewer than 100 employees. Since most Vermont businesses are small and since lots of them sell online or keep records in the cloud, today on Vermont Edition, we are going to learn more about why small companies are targeted and how to keep your business and your customers safe. The Vermont Small Business Development Center is actually holding two workshops on cybersecurity for small businesses, tomorrow in Williston and next Thursday in Springfield. We have details on our webpage, vpr.net/Vermont Edition, and we're joined in the studio by Steve Paddock, business advisor for the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Also with us is John Burton, president and founder of the South Burlington networking and security company, NPI. He'll be doing the presentations along with Ryan Krieger, Assistant Attorney General for Vermont. They are both with us as well. Ryan and John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so John Burton, let's start with you. The big businesses have so many more credit card numbers, so much more personal identification because they have so many more customers. So that's a big bank for a criminal. Why are they then going for small businesses as well when they can get so much more in one chunk from a big business?
It's a great question. Small businesses tend to be more vulnerable because they don't take the time or have the resources to keep things updated primarily. So where big businesses have a large staff to continually update and protect, a lot of the people that are doing the hacking are just looking for low-lying fruit, looking for places where people aren't keeping things up to date.
So they know that small businesses are vulnerable, and even though it may take more small businesses to get a big chunk of data, they're still going to go for it?
Yeah, they also don't know where it could lead. Once they get into a business, they could find intellectual property or other things of value. So they're going to poke around everywhere they can.
Ryan Krieger, how do we even know that? Do all businesses have to report when they know their data has been breached?
Yes, under Vermont's Data Breach Notice Act, a business that has suffered a data breach does have to inform the office that it's had a breach and has to tell consumers that it has had a breach.
But that's only in Vermont, right?
So I believe 46 states currently have data breach notice acts. They all require that consumers be notified, and a handful also require that an attorney general's office be notified. And the attorney general's offices also all communicate with each other.
And in Vermont, businesses do have to report to the attorney general, as you said, just to re-clarify that.
Within 14 days of discovery or notice of the breach, they have to notify our office, yes. And that notice is kept confidential by our office.
And as you said, again, you know, they do have to notify their customers in almost every state if the customer's data has been potentially compromised.
That is correct. In Vermont, we actually have one of the strictest statutes. It's in the most expedient time possible and without unreasonable delay, but no more than 45 days. We're one of the few states that actually has that date limit on it.
45 days seems like a long time, though. If my credit card has been potentially compromised and I don't find out about it from the company for 45 days, there's a lot of damage that could have already been done. Presumably, I would have heard about it from my banking institution.
I completely agree with you that the most expedient time possible is often shorter than 45 days. One thing that we do hear from businesses a lot, and I think it's legitimate, is that sometimes you know something happened, but you're not completely sure it was a data breach, and businesses should have some time to figure that out. You don't want a business telling all of its customers that it lost their data and being wrong about it. And you don't want them telling, which we have seen in some of the national breaches, they come out and say, we think 2 million customers were lost. Oh, no, wait, it was 10 million. Oh, no, wait, it was 20 million. And then the business looks bad, like they don't know what they're doing, but they're really trying to get the information out as quickly as possible. So there is a balance. That said, we've seen businesses that take 6 to 8 months to get notice out, and that's way too long.
All right, so today we are talking about cybersecurity and data breaches, and we're looking at why small businesses are such targets for this kind of criminal activity. Listeners, do you feel like your data is safe in the hands of small local businesses? Or do you run your own business? How do you deal with cybersecurity and data security? How do you make sure businesses keep data safe when a breach has a greater effect on the customers than the business itself in many cases? Call us with your thoughts and your questions. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts and questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Steve Paddock here again with the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Are businesses telling you that this is a concern for them, a worry?
We do hear that from some businesses that it's a concern. And also, we try to raise the issue with businesses. A lot of times businesses will come to us with other issues, and we'll try to make them aware of, under the risk management category, their exposure in an area like this.
Is that a surprise to them frequently?
Sometimes it's less of a surprise, but they're maybe in denial about their exposure to it, and it's a tough area for some businesses to deal with if they don't have experience or any professional help in the area.
We got a note from Silas who says, computer security is an oxymoron. A famous quote about computer security is this: the second rule of computer security is do not connect to the web. The first rule of computer security is that you simply don't turn your computer on. So, John Burton, is that the solution?
Well, obviously, we use these tools every day for very important functions. So just disconnecting or turning off is not the solution. I believe that the industry will continue to evolve with better approaches and products. There's a lot going on, and I think it will get better because it's a key part of our life.
So let's paint a little bit of a picture for people who are trying to figure out what are we talking about here. So we're talking about a small business, like maybe somebody who has a craft business and sells online through their website. This is the kind of company that may be vulnerable?
It's all companies. That's certainly one category that's very tied to the web for their income and their commerce. And they have to make sure that they adhere to the proper security for the payment card industry if they're taking credit cards online. So that's one segment. Another is just a grocery store out in rural Vermont that's taking credit cards, or maybe even not, just doing any other kind of transaction with their distributor or partners. Needs to make sure that their computer integrity continues.
And there's, go ahead, Ryan Krieger.
Jane, if I could also add, we're focused a lot on malicious individuals, hackers. A lot of data breaches that we see involve an unencrypted laptop that gets lost, or a thumb drive, backup tapes get lost. Sometimes companies accidentally post sensitive information to their own websites. One that we've seen a couple times is an ex-employee, maybe a disgruntled employee, leaves and takes equipment with them. And so what was a labor dispute now becomes a data breach. So it's not just bad guys hacking in. A lot of times there's other circumstances that can cause data breaches.
Yeah, good point. John Burton, is there no, leaving aside somebody like a disgruntled employee who has the ability to collect that data, or, a thumb drive that's left out, for companies that just want to make sure they have at least the minimum security systems in place, is there no sort of plug-in or plug-and-play that they can use?
We all wish there were a silver bullet. There really isn't a single technical solution for the problem, and Ryan pointed out some of the people issues. And in fact, variety of the problems do come down to people issues. So I think your best defense is training, is making sure your employees are understanding the best practices possible and continuing to update on that practice. So safe surfing, good process throughout the organization can go a long way.
But there's not something that you can do that will guarantee security.
I don't want to interrupt.
No, go ahead, Ryan.
First off, John is absolutely right. Education of the employees is the top thing you can do. But one of the best things you can do to avoid data breaches is not collect certain information in the first place. If you have a website and you're doing e-commerce, you can redirect your customers to an Amazon or a Google Wallet or a completely separate third-party payment collector.
So like that, PayPal?
But then the thing is, if PayPal gets hacked, it's their issue. They're the ones who you can go to and say, look, you need to handle this notice and things like that. Also, if you look at it's tough to say in hindsight, but generally speaking, the Amazons of the world are probably going to do a better job securing e-commerce than your little website that you might develop yourself. So trying to offsource that is a good way of saying, well, at least we're not actually collecting the information.
Steve Paddock, do you find small companies in Vermont are comfortable with that kind of collaboration?
They generally like that because it keeps them from having to develop that capacity on their own website, and they do rely on those external third-party providers for the security that they bring to it.
John Burton, do you suggest that too?
Absolutely. The best thing you can do is to partner with somebody that has strength in that area, has looked at all the compliance requirements across the country, and has got the resources to adhere to that.
All right, small business owners, I know you're out there. If you have a question, if this either comes as a surprise to you to think about how unsecure your business may be, or if you want to know about what you're doing and if it's likely to work, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from South Newfane. Hi, Richard. Go right ahead.
Hi. Up until now, I'm a craftsman. I go to outdoor craft shows. I've just taken cash and checks, but I'm finding I probably need to get the square, and I was going to get a mini iPad with it. Is there anything specific I should look out for to take extra care with doing things this way? Because I've never done credit cards before, and this is supposedly totally secure. But.
And Richard, just what you're talking about here, the square, that's that little thing that you plug into an iPhone or an iPad, and it's a square, and then you can swipe a credit card through it?
Right. It how it operates is the credit card, when you put the magnetic strip through it, it makes a little noise. So it's fed into the part that gives you a microphone on or an ear
headphones
phone, or your phone or your iPad.
Okay, Richard, thanks for the question. John Burton, what do you think?
The square is very popular with a lot of merchants. They do provide a very good level of security for payment card industry. You want to make sure that you're on the latest version of their products, and you want to validate, no matter what vendor you're using, that they are complying with what's called the PCI standard. There's a new standard that came out this year, version 3. You want to make sure they're conforming to version 3 of the PCI standard.
And otherwise, so generally, you know, nothing 100% safe, but it's considered a pretty good system to use that?
It's one of the major players, and so far I've not heard any concerns with it, the technology.
Ryan Krieger, when we talk about these data breaches and we look at customers' data being compromised, and sometimes this can lead to real problems for customers, so we know that they are victims in this. Does it have any effect on businesses themselves? Are businesses victims, even if it's the consumer and customer data that is compromised?
Well, I'd say in the vast majority of cases we've seen, it's usually the customer data that's compromised. I think the small businesses that we're looking at, certainly at the national level, you have the situation where intellectual property is stolen and things like that. I don't think that's as big with small business here. But I will say that even within the last week, we got a call from a company that wasn't sure whether they had a data breach. What they had experienced was ransomware. And ransomware gets delivered the same way a lot of other data breaches. Malicious software could get downloaded through an attachment or a link on an email, or you could even go to a website that someone has altered to download software. That's one of the things about small businesses, is that a lot of this is not an individual directly accessing you. They're just putting malware out on the internet and hoping it lands. And what ransomware does is it takes over your server or your hard drives, and it encrypts the whole thing. And then it sends you a message saying, give us X amount of dollars by this date. After this date, we're going to double the amount of money. And if you don't give us the money, we're going to wipe your systems. And we actually are working with a business right now that is undergoing that, a small Vermont business. And what we've done is we have put them in touch with some forensic experts who work with our state, who are helping them out, who might be able to help them. And that's actually something that we do with small businesses. We have a dual role here. We both enforce our law, but especially in the data security area, we often work with small businesses, offering them advice, sometimes offering them additional forensics support, where it's very clear that they don't have the resources to do it themselves.
You know, so that shows one way that a business might be vulnerable, and the business itself is particularly vulnerable. John Burton and Steve Paddock, one of the things that I read in preparing for this show suggested that for a lot of small businesses, a security breach, even though it affects their customers, can have an effect on the business. In fact, something like 60% of them, some surveys show, had to shut shop after a big data breach. And I don't know whether that's because the press is bad after you have to tell your customers that their information may have been compromised, or because it actually affects the finances of the business. But is that something that resonates with you, that this can be a big problem for small businesses even staying open? Steve?
There are plenty of small businesses that are vulnerable to small things, or seemingly small things, that can have a big impact on them. And I haven't worked with any clients who have experienced that, but it's not hard to imagine that that can happen.
The national statistics support that a single data breach can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars between the forensics, as Ryan was talking about, which would be to investigate, find the source of the breach, find all possible holes that they might have penetrated to seal them back up. Sometimes it means buying products. It means putting a lot of time into it. And as you mentioned, during that whole process, until you're solid again, you could have loss of reputation and actual revenue.
We are talking about cybersecurity today. Specifically, we're finding out that small businesses are even more vulnerable than the big businesses you often hear about when these data breaches come out in the news. We've been learning a little bit about the reasons why small operations are so frequently hit. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about how they can protect themselves and you, their customers. We're going to hear from other business owners. Linda's on the line waiting to ask a question about investigations. And if you want to ask a question or share your experiences, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're learning about cybersecurity issues for small businesses and how these business owners can make sure they're protected and that they're protecting their customers. The Vermont Small Business Development Center is sponsoring two workshops in the next few days, one in northern Vermont tomorrow and one in southern Vermont next Thursday. And Stephen Paddock is from the center. He's with us today. So is John Burton with the networking and security company NPI and Assistant Attorney General Ryan Krieger. And listeners, if you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. Have you had your information compromised? How did you find out and how did you feel about it? And if you are a small business owner, we'd love to hear what questions you have about how to make sure your website is secure, how you talk about personnel issues, and how you deal with this whole issue of cybersecurity. Let's go right to the calls. Linda's on the line with us from White River Junction. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was wondering who I could call about this problem, and then I was listening to your show. I was just on vacation last week, and my card was declined at a restaurant, and I thought it was because I hadn't told them I was going out of state. So I called them, and turns out the number had been hacked, and there were four charges on my account, one for $500, one for $495, and a few smaller ones. And they were very good about it. They canceled it, but they canceled my card, so I didn't have my card available for the rest of the vacation. And I'm just wondering, who investigates this? It seems to me it would be pretty easy to go to the vendor and find out who ordered whatever was on that charge. You know, one was melon.com for $500. Well, they would have had to put some kind of a delivery address or something. Who has jurisdiction over this? And I think these people should be prosecuted and sent to jail, and that might send them a message, you know?
Linda, thanks for the call. Some interesting issues there. Some of them, you know, may be related to the small businesses where perhaps Linda's information was hacked from. But Ryan Krieger, bottom line, how do these investigations happen, and what about Linda's concerns?
Well, I think in terms of actually finding the folks who are doing the actual hacking and the malware, those cases are often handled by the Secret Service and the FBI. Those cases are frequently across state lines. Often they are from individuals who are outside the United States borders. So we definitely cooperate with them and we work with them to help bring down the actual bad guys. But those often are a federal issue.
So when a local company comes to you and reports, as it is required to do, to the state, to the Attorney General's office, that it has had a data breach, what do you do?
Well, often we take an advisory role. Not a lot of issues that we deal with do we offer direct legal advice, but this is one where we do because it is kind of a complicated situation. We suggest what they need to do to take remedial measures. The first thing a company has to do if they found out they might have been breached is to investigate to determine whether they have had a breach and then to fix it. If they have malware on their computers, they have to remove the malware. One of the best case scenarios we ever saw was a company that called us, found out they'd had a breach. They'd immediately removed all the hard drives from all their computers, contacted Secret Service, contacted us. And when we hear something like that happening, we basically kind of sit back and say, you guys have this. You know, it sounds like you're doing the right thing. On the other hand, sometimes we get a call and it's along the lines of, I shouldn't have to deal with this. I really don't want to notify consumers. This isn't my problem. When we hear that the business kind of wants to put its head in the sand and is not putting the consumer's protection first, that's when we have to get a little bit more aggressive and say, listen, you have to fix this. You have to get the notice out. Penalty for not getting notice out can be up to $10,000 per person you don't notify. Usually when we start saying that, they come around to, okay, we need to comply. We need to get this done right. So we definitely want to be very helpful with businesses. And we even have resources sometimes if the business doesn't have the resource. But if we think they're not going to comply, then we have to get a little bit more our enforcement hat on.
Well, and I'm curious to hear from businesses if you feel like you do have the resources to do this kind of work, if you feel like you have a pretty good understanding of how to keep the data that you're collecting secure, if you even know what data you're collecting and where it goes, and what do you do to make sure that you are taking preventive measures. If you feel like you've got this pretty well under your belt, give us a call. Let me know. 1-800-639-2211.
Let me add a little more background of what probably happened to Linda.
Yeah.
The people that steal a lot of these credit card numbers, it's an industry. It's a very large, powerful industry broken into various functions. So it's likely that one person stole the credit cards, sold it to several other middlemen who organized it in databases and sold it to other middlemen. And eventually somebody bought it for a fee that wanted to do something with it. They'll test the number to see if it would support a small transaction, and then they'll try progressively larger transactions. And as Ryan said, a lot of this is either out of state or much of it is overseas. So poor Linda really doesn't have a lot of recourse to get a hold of these people and do much with them in terms of the criminal activity. And it's also many times things are stolen because it's a copy made, and you're asking how does a small business know they've had a hack? It's not like when somebody steals a product off your shelf or breaks a window. There's almost no evidence many times that you've had that penetration until somebody reports, like Linda, that my credit card has been compromised. And the major credit card companies are working hard to develop systems. They have some now that will triangulate and recognize that all these 10 credit cards had something in common. They were all used at 10 o'clock at a certain merchant. And they'll call the merchant and say, hey, we think you've had a problem.
So that is happening. For example, I recently had my bank told me your debit card has been compromised. We're sending you a new one and we're shutting off the old one. It didn't tell me where that compromise had happened. So I have no idea what merchant it may or may not have been. But the debit card company, the bank, said, we're going to do something about this because you've been compromised.
Yeah, they're working hard to keep their costs down because there's a huge cost to the credit card industry for this. So they have systems, people, you know, a variety of techniques they're using to understand where did that compromise occur and take care of it.
We got a note from Dan who says, we got dinged several times. The real eye-opener was when someone purchased a domain similar to ours, copied our web page pretty much verbatim, got a Vermont phone number, and was actively soliciting funds on our behalf. Ryan Krieger, does that sound familiar to you? Have you heard of things like that happening?
Honestly, I think that if he would like to contact our office and let us know about that, you know, that is the first time we're hearing of that particular. I mean, we've heard about scams where people create similar websites happening in Vermont to a Vermont company. That's something we're definitely interested in knowing more about.
We also got a note from Scott who says, I'm listening to the cybersecurity show, and I'm wondering if the guests can address the idea that the PC platform is more vulnerable than the Mac platform. John Burton?
It's true. Over the many years of computing, that the Macintosh has had less crime perpetrated against it. Some of it is it's a less open platform. It's a little bit more of a sealed hardware and software combination. Some of it is just that there are just a lot more PCs out there than Macintoshes historically.
And let's go to Jake, who's on the line with us from Waterbury Center. Hi, Jake. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So my question is in regards to merchants and vendors who have to deal with credit card use. Is there a universal platform that's applied for these major credit card companies that people have to deal with a similar level of security, or is this something where people can typically buy their way into better protections from this, or am I coming at the issue from the wrong angle here?
John Burton, do you understand what Jake's asking?
Yes. The credit card industry got together and created a standard called the PCI standard, and it's recognizing that everybody uses different equipment, has a different situation, does transactions differently. You know, some are using the old technology of a dial-up modem to authorize a credit card. Others are doing it over the internet, their website. So there's all these different approaches to credit card authorization. So there isn't any way of buying into better security. You essentially, as a business or an individual, have to make your decisions about what is secure enough and what to invest in.
Steve Paddock, this clearly is enough of an issue that you feel like it's necessary for the Vermont Small Business Development Center to host a couple of workshops. John Burton and Ryan Krieger are participating in them for small business owners to address these kinds of issues. One is tomorrow in Williston. The other one is next Thursday in Springfield. We have a link to all of the details at vpr.net. But why is this something that you think businesses should be going to, should be getting more information about?
We wanted to bring it to the attention of our clients as well as other small businesses around the state, because it's the type of thing that they may not think about until it's too late for them. And so by having knowledge ahead, they can take steps to assess what their risk is and find the protection that is right for their size business.
Ryan Krieger and John Burton, before we let you go, a takeaway here for business owners and perhaps customers who may be listening about what they should be doing to make themselves safer. Ryan Krieger, we'll start with you.
Two quick points. First, there is a guidance on the Attorney General's website under privacy and data security. If you have any sort of breach or question, you can call us. The guidance is very thorough as what you should handle. And secondly, cyber insurance. It's a fairly new product. It is a little bit expensive, but it's much cheaper than the tens of thousands of dollars that a forensic analysis and notice could help. And they also have internal resources that will help you make yourself more safe ahead of time.
And John Burton.
I would definitely recommend that people don't throw up their hands and give up. There's a lot you can do that is of low cost or no cost, reaching out to the small business group and other resources, and continue on because it isn't just a big business problem, and it can be solved with a small budget too.
So you don't have to feel like, this isn't winnable. We're all just going to be hacked. Let's just live with it.
Got to continue the good fight.
That's John Burton. He's president and founder of the South Burlington Networking and Security Company, NPI. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Stephen Paddock is a business advisor for the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Thanks to you, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
And Ryan Krieger is an assistant attorney general for Vermont. Ryan, nice to talk with you as well.
Thank you.
And again, we do have information about those two workshops that are coming up in Springfield and in Williston. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition for all of the details. Coming up, musician Luke Reynolds on why Vermont draws him home from living in Nashville and Brooklyn and from international touring with the band Guster. This is Vermont Edition.
Wake on up. Let's not get lazy, love. We're always so lazy, love. We're wasting our time.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. That's the rock band Guster with the song Lazy Love from their newest album, Evermotion. Vermonters may be familiar with the frontman for that band, Ryan Miller, who has his own Vermont PBS show, Making Friends with Ryan Miller. But a few years ago, Guster welcomed a new member to the band, multi-instrumentalist Luke Reynolds. While Miller is a newcomer to Vermont, Luke Reynolds grew up here and he has strong ties to his home state. He just built a cabin in the woods in Lincoln, where he spends as much time as he can. So I visited Reynolds there recently to talk about his connection to Vermont, to Guster, and to his own solo work.
So we're here in your cabin. You and your dad built this cabin. You live mostly now in Brooklyn, but you've lived in LA, you've lived in Nashville, you do a lot of touring. Why was it important to have a space here and a space that you built?
I'm a sixth generation native Vermonter from Addison County, so I knew that my work as a musician was going to require that I move around a lot, and having a base camp set up somewhere was something that very much appealed to me. Lincoln, Vermont, where I built my cabin, has been my favorite town in Vermont since I was a little kid. So I was lucky enough to find a large chunk of land up here. This is the first house that I built from scratch. My dad and I built it together. it was a really wonderful experience.
It sounds like you and your dad have kind of an interesting relationship. You know, you built this house. Your dad builds instruments, right? So a lot of the instruments that you've played over the years were built by your dad.
Yeah, that's right. My dad's a really important person in my life. He's a boat builder. So when I was growing up, he was building traditional Adirondack guideboats and traditional canvas canoes. Collaborating on a project together was something that was new for him and me, especially because in a lot of ways, this is my project.
And he let you be the foreman?
He let me be the foreman. There was a learning curve on learning to work together in this way. Sharing a creative vision with someone can be challenging.
Your dad, you know, works a lot with his hands. Mm-hmm. And so this is part of your relationship. And as I said, playing his instruments. Mm-hmm. Do you see a similarity in being a musician and creating something, even if it's not as much of a physical activity as building stuff?
The relationship that I see between that is that I enjoy making the kind of music that I want to hear in the same way that I think my dad enjoys building the types of objects that he himself wants to find in the world. Whether it's the kind of traditional boat he wants to use or whether it's working on an archtop guitar, I think that we both share that, and I think that I learned that from watching him work. There's also a demystification process that happens that I've witnessed with him. It's like from working on this house together, you know, I love Scandinavian architecture, and I used to think like, oh man, I'll have to hire someone else to do that. But working with my dad on this project in this cabin was really cool. It's like, oh yeah, anybody can do that. I can do that. And it's similar with music and recordings. A lot of the music that I love and obsess over from other artists, once you get in there, you know, anyone can do it, really, if you hang in there long enough.
You said you like to be able to make music that makes you happy and make your own music.
Yeah, I love
it. How would you describe your music?
I don't know. I don't get interviewed very much about it. So I haven't spent a lot of time trying to articulate how my music sounds. I just made a record called After the Flood. And when I was starting to write that record, I kept these huge poster sheets and I hung them from the walls of my apartment, and I used them to keep track of what I was listening to and what I loved and what turned me on. And I was able to look up at the wall and jot an idea down or a lyric down or just brainstorm. And it was pretty eclectic. If I remember correct, it was Scott Walker and the Walker Brothers, Richard Swift, Nick Carey, a lot of fringe musicians from the 60s, psychedelia in the UK, the band Tomorrow, Electric, Muddy Waters, J.J. Cale, Ry Cooder, and many more. And when I hear After the Flood, I hear how all those records of theirs that I love influence the writing.
Is there one song in particular from After the Flood that you think really illustrates that eclectic musical taste and also that kind of collaborative approach?
The opening track on After the Flood is called A Million Miles Away, and that track coming off the floor in the recording studio was one of the hottest tracks that any of us had ever cut, and definitely felt touched by magic. I'm so kidding.
So your new album that we've been talking about, After the Flood, that title may give Vermonters a picture. Certainly Vermonters have been thinking a lot about life after the flood of Tropical Storm Irene. Yeah. But as somebody who lives in New York, you know, there's also all that flooding.
Sure.
Is that a reference to either of those?
No, it's actually not. It's a reference to the first poem in Rimbaud's Illuminations, which is Après la Deluge, which is after the flood. that collection of poetry by Rimbaud was incredibly important to me while I was writing that record. So.
This is among the books of poetry that your now wife yeah. gave to you?
Yeah,
I should say you got. We're talking here in your cabin 5 days after you got married.
Yeah, I'm fresh. I love it. I didn't know I was going to love being married this much. Yeah, Abby, basically I was looking to get free, to free up the way I thought about writing and the way I felt about recording and the way that I felt about playing. And Abby somehow knew that feeding me a bunch of French symbolist poetry was the right thing to do at the right time, to her credit. But Illuminations, that was the one for me that I felt really helped unlock me and open me up.
Lights are changing from red to green, but there's no cars in the streets. There's footsteps on the floorboards above, and baby, I can't sleep. The future's uncertain, but you're holding me tight.
I made that record because I needed to make that record. It was out of necessity. Amongst groups of professional musicians, I feel like everyone's always talking about, I wish I was working on cooler music. I wish that I was working on music that I loved. Well, it's one thing to talk about wanting to work on music that you love. It's another thing, someone has to be the guy that goes out there and creates a body of work for everyone to go cut. So I had a few months off of touring, and so I did that.
So then, Luke, when you're touring with Guster, yep. this is a group that you joined, what, 4 years ago now?
5 years ago now.
They've been a band since 91.
Yeah,
I mean, with a little bit different, you know, configurations sure. over time. But Ryan Miller and Adam Gardner, I mean, they founded it at Tufts in 91 when they were freshmen.
Yep.
So this is a band that's really well established and is somebody else's vision.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you are an owner of this group, or is this a gig that you do to pay the rent and to be with friends, but it's not your music?
There's two sides to that. So the band, until recently, was very much their vision. And to their credit, they built something that's really special and unique. When I was first asked to join the band in 2010, I was very much serving their vision and their music. And I worked really hard to do that. Most recently, we have put out a record called Evermotion, came out a few months back. And I helped write that record. I helped write the entire record, played on the entire record, and I'm an equal owner in that. So this is a new chapter for me and my involvement with Guster, in that I very much have ownership in this new body of work.
You mentioned a minute ago that when you were building this album after the flood, it was really, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, it was a little bit of a departure for you because
yeah.
you wanted to make some changes. Mm-hmm. If I'm reading between the lines, it sounds like maybe you were a little burned out on what you had been doing.
Very much so, yeah, and I'm not shy about that at all. I look at the records that I made before. My first real prop record I made was called Burning in the Sun with Blue Merle. I was 22 or 23 years old when I wrote that record. And when I listen to that record now, I feel, wow, that's a 22, 23-year-old kid. It's like losing your virginity in the music business. That's the coolest way that that could have happened. I didn't feel pressure at the time when I was writing it. And there's a couple songs on there still that I'm incredibly proud of. And just like looking at pictures of yourself in high school, right?
Slightly embarrassing.
Slightly
but also
embarrassing.
Pretty
cool. I think that's just part of making art and being an artist, is trying to do the best you can where you're at in your life. But
Blue Merle, if I can interrupt
sure.
you, I mean, that was a group that you had a little bit of a firework with Blue Merle. I mean,
yeah.
you got on some
major
some,
label.
Yeah.
We were essentially a bluegrass band from Nashville, Tennessee that got signed to Island Def Jam alongside Jay-Z. Right.
right. So, which, yeah,
right?
It was a little odd.
A little odd. And you know, when I was starting Blue Merle, the goal was to move to Nashville, just like right now. It's just find the best peers you can. That was the goal. And fast forward a couple of years, and we had a major label record deal and a major publishing deal. And it was a whirlwind experience, and we were moderately successful. We sold 80,000 records and got to play Farm Aid with Willie Nelson and Neil Young. And it was a really important experience for me to have in my life.
You guys made it to some extent, but it also must have been interesting at the time. This was when Coldplay was really big.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is the only other time I've ever interviewed you was after that record came out. And I mentioned to you the critique. At the time, it sounded a little bit like Coldplay. You have a voice that has some similarities to Chris Martin, mm-hmm. and it was like Coldplay with a ukulele. And I can remember, you know, we weren't face-to-face, but I could feel you rolling your eyes, like,
sure.
just would everybody please shut up about the Coldplay references. You mentioned it's like looking at high school pictures.
Sure.
When you're a high schooler,
sure.
most people are pretty scared about who they are, and mm-hmm. a critique like that can be pretty wounding when you're 23, less wounding perhaps when you're 36.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I've been a professional musician now for almost 14 years. And at the time, you're right, having comparisons about the music you're making, the art that you're creating to someone else, it hurts the ego. You know, the similarities that Chris Martin and I might have had 10 years ago, we both have scruffy voices and sing in a falsetto occasionally, and we're also both incredibly handsome, talented, and modest.
Right. Well, I didn't want to say that, but right, sure.
But the ego of a 23-year-old is, I want to make something that's just my own. Well, ultimately, you can't control what other people think of your music or what you want to compare to. And what the benefit of now 14 years into being a professional musician is that I just see that that's just part of the game. Every year, there's another touchstone for someone to be compared to. It happens to all bands. And 14 years in, it doesn't bother me anymore, also because I noticed that the records change so much. The records, the art that you're creating, the music you're making, the records you're building, they're going to change on their own. What I'm interested is to, over the course of my life, build a body of work that I can stand behind and say, I made these records and I can still stand behind them. I can stand behind this point. I would love to be 70 years old and be able to pick one or two songs off each record of my career and still stand behind them and be like, that's a great song. That would be something that would be really sweet.
So the long-term goal is stay in music. You're going to be 70 and still...
I don't know. I guess that's the only time I ever said it out loud, but the long-term goal would be to stay in music as long as I love it. And so far, I found that I continue to fall back in love with it. It goes low, it goes high, it goes low, it goes high. It's just part of it. It doesn't scare me anymore. It used to scare me when I would fall out of love with music. It's like, geez, I just committed like 10 years of my life to this and relationships and, you know. But it doesn't scare me anymore because making music, specifically cutting records, is something that I return to and brings me so much joy and deep, immense satisfaction on multiple levels that I hope that I will continue to fall back in love with it. Always.
Well, Luke Reynolds, thanks for talking with me.
Jane, I love hearing your voice, and I'm so glad you came to my cabin. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Stars were born. There were no cities, buildings, or people. There were no suns to rise, no sunsets in the evening. And then one day, everything happened.
Luke Reynolds' new album is called After the Flood. It's out now, and we have a link to Luke's website at vpr.net. Okay, let's look ahead to tomorrow's show. We'll be discussing Vermont's rivers. Parts of the Missisquoi and Trout Rivers have received the federal Wild and Scenic designation. But while that's being celebrated, there are concerns that our rivers are conduits for phosphorus runoff that ends up in our lakes. We'll look at the challenges and solutions for improving river health. Send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy and Amanda Shepherd. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.